And that's why it's so important that the UN is ready through this mechanism.
Before the war, one third of the global fertilizer trade, as well as roughly one quarter of crude oil and a fifth of liquefied natural gas, passed through the Strait of Hormuz. But tanker traffic has essentially come to a standstill for nearly 2 months. For more, we're joined now by Adam Khanieh, who's been closely following this. His latest piece in the Financial Times has headlined "The Coming Global Food Crisis." Adam Khanieh is director of the SOAS Middle East Institute at the University of London, and his most recent book is "Crude Capitalism: Oil, Corporate Power, and the Making of the World Market." He joins us now from Shanghai, China. Professor Khanieh, welcome back to Democracy Now. Now, if you could just begin by laying out all the different factors leading to a possible global food crisis, the signs of which actually are evident already in several countries.
Thank you, Naomi. Yes, the article argues that we need to move away from just considering the Gulf as oil and gas producers and actually think very carefully about the ways that they have diversified down the value chain into things like fertilizers. As you pointed out, about a third of the world's basic fertilizers now pass through the Strait of Hormuz. And in some of these chemicals like urea and ammonia, the Gulf monarchies stand as some of the world's largest producers. So the closure of the transport through the Strait of Hormuz has really strangled the global supply of these key fertilizer inputs. It's not just a question of supply shortages, of course. We're actually seeing price rises accompany this process as well. So we see supply shortages of fertilizers, price rises of fertilizers, as well, of course, price rises of basic energy, including gas and oil, which impact very deeply farmers and agricultural systems around the world. So this is, I think, as we've heard earlier, the Food and Agricultural Organization warning of the impact of this. And I think it is now that this real reality is actually becoming very clear.
Professor Khanieh, the piece actually begins with laying out why it is that countries have become more dependent on the fossil fuel industry for the production of food. If you could explain what the Green Revolution did and how over the decades it's made fossil fuels so central to all kinds of agricultural production.
Yes, the Green Revolution was an enormous transformation to agricultural production that took place in the post-war period through the 1950s and 1960s in particular. Countries like India, Mexico, and elsewhere were major epicenters of this revolution. And what it essentially did was it tied the introduction of new seed varieties to fossil fuel inputs, in particular synthetic fertilizers, as well as pesticides, and of course, the mechanization of farm work itself, irrigation and so forth, that depended also on these on fuel imports, fossil fuel imports as well, inputs as well. So this kind of transformation brought with it enormous social and ecological costs that have been documented very well by those who study the Green Revolution. But it has done something actually much more fundamental which is being illustrated in this current war, is that it tied our food systems to fossil fuel inputs. It really closely tied the way that we do agriculture with these basic fossil fuel chemicals as well as energy sources. So when we see a moment of crisis as we do today, that's when these links become so apparent.
And you speak specifically, in fact, in the piece about nitrogen fertilizer. Oh, sorry, the most widely used of nitrogen fertilizer is urea. So where is this produced and where exported? And what's happening with its production and distribution now?
Well, there's nitrogen fertilizers are very important to consider in this story, because half of the world's food production depends upon this kind of fertilizers. We're talking here about things like urea and ammonia. These are the essential nitrogen fertilizers, and the Gulf monarchies have become leading exporters of these fertilizers. So Saudi Arabia is the world's largest exporter of urea, for instance. Oman, another Gulf monarchy, is the fourth largest. So these nitrogen products are no longer being shipped through the Strait of Hormuz from these countries, and this really does impact very dramatically the ability of countries like India, for instance, that depends very heavily. About three quarters of India's ammonia imports come from the Gulf region, for instance. 30% of Morocco's nitrogen imports, ammonia imports, come from the Gulf. So these countries could become very heavily impacted when these supplies are cut.
So let's go to what the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN is warning. Maximo Torero, who is the chief economist of the FAO, spoke earlier this month about how the strait's continued closure could affect decisions made by farmers.
As we move to April and we move to May especially, then there will be decisions made by farmers. And that will imply that they will choose to move towards producing with less inputs if the strait continues not to have mobility. It will imply that they will move to other commodities which they can fix more nitrogen, like, for example, move from wheat or maize to soybeans. And it will imply that they could allocate, because they will allocate more of these resources to biofuels. That will restrict the capacity, the amount of supply of commodities of food. And of course, that will start to increase prices. And you have to add to that the uncertainties. The more uncertainty we have over the next weeks, the more the transmission will move. And if that transmission keeps moving, we will have a period of higher food prices, commodity prices, and higher food inflation.
So that's the FAO's chief economist. Professor Hanye, if you could comment on what he said.
I think it's really important to understand this coming food crisis as an intersection of multiple crises. We are, of course, as we've just heard, going to see price rises in food and in fuel. But we are also experiencing the moment the climate and debt crises in much of the global south. So it's a perfect storm, if you like, of this food, fuel, climate, and debt crises that are all very deeply connected to one another. In that sense, it's different from earlier food crises like the 2008 or 2022 following Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. So you could take a country, for instance, like Sudan. Sudan is reliant upon the Gulf for more than 50% of its fertilizers, which is actually the most reliant of any country in the world from imports from the Gulf region. And Sudan is a country suffering, of course, from 3 years of civil war. Indeed, many of the actors involved in this civil war are the Gulf monarchies themselves, particularly Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So it's a country that's enduring famine across major parts of its territory. About 40%, according to the World Food Programme, of Sudan's population are currently experiencing famine conditions. About 19 million people. So acute levels of food insecurity in Sudan. And it's also experiencing massive levels of displacement. About 1 in 3 people are being displaced. So we overlay this kind of conflict crisis alongside the questions of food, fuel, and debt, and the inability, of course, of humanitarian assistance to get into Sudan now, because that has also been interrupted as a result of this war against Iran. We really see this perfect storm affecting many countries surrounding the Middle East.
Professor Hanier, we'll go back in a second to the issue of debt for many countries in the developing world, which you also talk about in your piece. But another point you make is to return to the centrality of the Gulf countries, that the UAE now ranks as among the top five re-export hubs in the world. So if you could explain what this means for the distribution of food around the world, and talk also about Dubai's Jebel Ali port, which is the world's largest human-made harbor, as you point out.
Yes, this is another critical part of the economic transformations that have taken place in the Gulf over recent decades. The emergence of the Gulf states, in particular the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and in particular the Dubai Emirate, where Jebel Ali Port is located, have emerged as key logistics centers globally. This means, of course, ports, as well as shipping infrastructure, air corridors, connected to economic zones, free zones, these kinds of logistics networks, which have now become deeply centered in the region. So when we talk about Dubai as one of the top five re-exporters, what that means is that goods are imported into Dubai and then exported elsewhere. So the Dubai and other Gulf states, but in particular Jebel Ali Port, supplies a lot of the goods that are consumed not just in the Middle East, but also in surrounding areas like in the African continent and South Asia, where goods come into Dubai and then are re-exported there, including, of course, food. So this adds another dimension to the emerging crisis, because with those logistics corridors no longer operating, it makes it very difficult for countries to actually import their food through these logistics networks. One striking fact is that China, for instance, exports about 60% of China's exports to Europe and Africa pass through Dubai, pass through the UAE. So that shows its centrality to global trade. And of course, one of the reasons that the Emirates, Dubai, has become this epicenter of global trade is because of its role in the distribution of food.
Professor Hanier, to talk about another issue that you raise that is exacerbating this crisis, which is that the developing world is already deeply debt-distressed. UNCTAD, or the UN Conference on Trade and Development, has said developing countries paid a record $921 billion only in interest payments in 2024. If you could talk about the implications of this.
This is a hugely important factor to consider. It's been described as the worst debt crisis on record, worse than the so-called lost decade of the 1980s. What this concerns, of course, as you've just stated, is that countries are paying interest, servicing their debt, but still taking on new debt on top of that. So what this means is that countries are no longer able to afford or to adequately pay for basic services like health, education, or other kinds of social infrastructure. Currently, the number of countries in the Global South that are paying more to their external creditors, to their lenders in debt servicing than they receive in fresh loans, has doubled over the last decade, which really shows the striking situation that many countries face today. About 3.4 billion people in the world are paying more on interest payments on their debt than they are on health or education. Again, a striking figure that really shows the situation that countries are coming into facing this looming crisis. So I really think when we think about the potential impact of this war against Iran, we need to think about the situation that countries are already in, the multiple crises that they're facing, in order to understand what the impact of these kinds of trade shortages might be.
And finally, Professor Hanier, before we end, if you could say, even if the fighting were to stop today and the strait is reopened, is it already too late to avert a global food crisis?
Well, I think we're getting very close to that point. The question, we look at kind of the predictions around energy prices moving forward, and also food prices. Earlier on, a few weeks ago, the Food and Agriculture Organization estimated for the first half of 2026 that prices of fertilizers would be 20% higher, and this is now the war has been much prolonged since that estimate was made. So I think the kind of knock-on effects that we will see, we're already seeing fertilizer shipments being diverted to those wealthier countries that can pay. And it does mean, I think, that price rises and food inflation are certainly on the cards for the remainder of the year.
Professor Hanier, thank you so much for joining us. Director of the SOAS Middle East Institute at the University of London. His most recent book is Crude Capitalism, Oil, Corporate Power, and the Making of the World Market. We'll link to your new piece in the Financial Times, The Coming Global Food Crisis. Coming up, are officials and staffers in the Trump administration directly profiting from the war by placing well-timed bets on prediction markets just before President Trump announces major developments in the war? Stay with us.
Let me be your June bug till your dragonfly comes. Let me be your June bug. Dragonfly come. I could do more dragon than the dragonfly done. Let me be your little crow till your raven come. Let me be
Michael Hurley performing Let Me Be Your Junebug. We turn now to the dark world of online betting markets that allow bets on virtually any news event. For a small group of traders, the war with Iran has been a windfall. On the night of February 27th, 16 bets on the trading platform known as Polymarket made $100,000 each for accurately predicting when the U.S. would strike Iran. Soon after, one trader made over $500,000 betting that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would be toppled moments before he was assassinated by Israeli forces. The same surge was seen in oil futures trading as well. Right before President Trump announced a temporary ceasefire with Iran on March 7th, traders bet $950 million that oil prices would drop, which they did. On the same day, 50 Polymarket accounts placed bets that the U.S. and Iran would reach a ceasefire before Trump announced it on social media. Overall, traders have placed over $1 billion in perfectly timed wagers relating to the Iran war. A recent analysis by the BBC of online bets placed throughout President Trump's second term found a consistent pattern of spikes just hours or sometimes minutes before a social media post or media statement from President Trump was made public. The timing of these bets and the huge windfalls they've created are raising concerns of possible insider trading. Prediction markets and platforms like Polymarket and its biggest competitor, Kalshi, are governed by the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or the CFTC. This means they can avoid state-level restrictions in place for traditional gambling and sports betting today. A growing number of states are trying to stop this, but the Trump administration has pushed back. Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has advisory roles in both Polymarket and Kalshi. For more, we're joined now from Washington, D.C. by Amanda Fisher, Policy Director and Chief Operating Officer for Better Markets, an advocacy organization focusing on making financial markets fair and accountable. She was previously the Chief of Staff and Senior Counselor to the Chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. Welcome to Democracy Now, Amanda Fisher. If you could just begin by laying out what has been happening in prediction markets, particularly since the Iran war began.
Yes, thank you for having me. And, you know, these markets have actually existed for decades, and they have a good purpose and intent in that original design of the markets. And it's to allow companies in the real economy to manage their exposure to volatile commodities like oil and basically place bets that will pay out to them if the prices spike. But in recent years, and particularly since the inauguration of President Trump, we have seen an explosion of these event contracts available to retail users using apps, you know, on their phones that allow them to bet on everything from frivolous things like celebrities and pop culture to what will happen to the price of Bitcoin in the next 15 minutes, to things as grave and serious as war and proxies for war. And the real innovation that has taken place in the last 18 months or so is that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is supposed to police what bets are available on these markets and really narrow the focus to be on bets that help people in the real economy manage real commercial risks, they have stood down their enforcement and oversight. And now we see just really a proliferation in any number of gambling opportunities available to people in the United States and around the world.
And could you explain, Amanda, how these prediction markets work? Most jurisdictions here do not require polymarket users to disclose their names. Unlike the stock market, users are presented with a binary option, yes or no. So they're actually competing against one another. And the fact that polymarkets use cryptocurrency, if you could tell us what the implications of these things are in terms of regulating the industry.
Yeah, it's a great question. So Polymarket is not yet licensed to operate in the United States, but they're seeking to. But during the Biden administration, the CFTC with the Department of Justice found that Polymarket was offering their bets to U.S. Traders without the appropriate licensing. And they entered into a settlement and a consent order that required Polymarket to geo-block anyone signing in from the United States. But since the Trump administration came in, there is really not a lot of clarity around if that prohibition is actually being enforced. And obviously, all of this aberrant trading activity around the Iran war raises questions on if people in the United States are placing these bets and profiting. And I think the president's family's involvement in Polymarket as advisors really heighten concerns that perhaps Polymarket is not abiding by the restrictions put in place in 2022. And further, they are seeking to expand in the United States and have licensing pending with the regulator, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Amanda, do we know when exactly did Trump's family become involved in these prediction markets as advisors, including, of course, most prominently, Trump's son?
You know, similar to the president's involvement in cryptocurrency, this all happened around the time of the election and the inauguration. And it's, and again, as you mentioned at the top of this segment, you know, his son is an advisor both to Polymarket and its competitor, Kalshi, which is highly irregular to be an advisor to two firms competing directly head to head in the market. And it's really no accident that just really weeks after the inauguration took place, the CFTC, the regulatory agency, stood down on a legal challenge to Kalshi offering bets on election outcomes, U.S. election outcomes. And then also the platforms exploded and started offering bets on sporting events, which have traditionally been regulated by state gambling commissions. And now we see a proliferation of bets related to activities that really ought to be prohibited under U.S. law. So there is a strict prohibition on offering gambling related to war, assassination, terrorism, gaming, activities that are illegal under state law, or anything that's contrary to the public interest. But the CFTC, under President Trump, has completely retrenched from any enforcement of what kind of contracts are made available on these platforms.
Well, let's go to the beginning of the war on Iran. On the very day the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran, numerous bets were made on prediction markets, drawing criticism from lawmakers. On Polymarket alone, $500 million was traded over when the U.S. would bomb Iran. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy posted on X, quote, "It's insane. This is legal. People around Trump are profiting off war and death. I am introducing legislation ASAP to ban this." Meanwhile, Senator Richard Blumenthal argued that prediction markets are, quote, "turning war into a casino game and creating a market for national security leaks." So, Amanda, if you could comment on that, and also in particular, what effects prediction markets now have on real world events? What kinds of incentives are created by profits?
It's a great question, and these instances of outsized profits around the announcement of major military actions raises a lot of concerns. It obviously erodes trust in our democracy, creates national security threats around the leakage of sensitive information, and you know, law enforcement agencies in the United States should be looking into whether or not people in the United States were making these bets on offshore platforms and looking to follow the money and trace it back. I unfortunately don't have a lot of confidence that that is actually taking place. So, you know, it just introduces so much risk. Think about, you know, there are frivolous things like if a streaker is going to run out during a soccer game, right? And then that obviously incents someone to go streak at the soccer game. But take that example and put it in a life and death situation around whether or not a strike hits a particular location in a global conflict. Not only does that encourage particular targets to be hit, but somebody also has to be the arbiter of whether or not the strike took place, because as we know, news events can be ambiguous. It requires people to sort through and provide objective information on what happened. So we already have one example of a journalist being harassed and stalked online because his reporting said that a strike did not happen, and people who had placed bets wanted him to change his journalism to say that it did happen so that they could win out on their wager.
And just to go back to a point that you made earlier, Amanda, the fact that Polymarket was founded here in the U.S., an American CEO, in fact, a very young man who went on to become the first self-made billionaire in the country, in the world, in fact. So if it's founded here in the U.S., why were U.S. customers barred from using it?
Because in order to offer these types of wagers in the United States, you have to have the appropriate licensing from that agency, the CFTC, and Polymarket did not have that licensing. And also, I should really underscore that, again, these platforms were designed to offer opportunities for companies in the real economy to manage their exposure to corn price fluctuations, soybean price fluctuations, gas price fluctuations. It was not meant to be a retail betting app. So the fact that they were
I'm afraid we're
going
to have to leave it there. Amanda Fisher, Policy Director and Chief Operating Officer for Better Markets. She was previously the Chief of Staff and Senior Counselor to the Chair of the SEC. And that does it for today's show. Amy Goodman will be back tomorrow, broadcasting from Seattle. She'll be speaking in Seattle tonight and tomorrow after the screenings of the new documentary about Democracy Now called Steal This Story, Please. Today, it'll screen at SIFF Cinema Uptown at 4:15 and 7 p.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. Amy will then head to Portland, Oregon. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
How much do you love this station? People dedicated to your community. News that directly matters to you. This station needs your support. Go to mycri.ca to find out more about the Community Radio Initiative, which will provide core funding for this station. At MyCRI, you will find an easy way to create an email that you can send to the politicians who need to hear your message. Just 5 minutes and a few clicks make a big difference. MyCRI.ca.